Thanks for tuning in to another Mining Stock Education episode. I'm Bill Powers. Today I'll be speaking with the editor of the Mining Stock Journal, Dave Kranzler. We'll be discussing gold, junior gold stocks, shorting mining stocks, and the electrical vehicle revolution. Dave also runs a mining stock fund out of Denver, and his latest insights can be found on his website, investmentresearchdynamics.com. Dave, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on again, Bill. I love doing this show. You always have great questions and great comments.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your insights. That's why I asked you on. And the first question I'd like to jump into is regarding your current thoughts on the gold market, and specifically how the miners are performing relative to the price of gold. What do you foresee or analyze right now?
You know, we've been kind of trading in a range here in the gold market. At the high end, as everyone probably knows, 1360 area. And at the low end, just call it 1300. I actually didn't think they'd be able to get gold below 1300 again, but obviously they did. And I always preface my shorter term forecasts with the market's so heavily manipulated. Anything is possible in the short term. It's really an impossible market to forecast. But my personal view is that I think gold is kind of percolating, or call it coiling. I guess some technical stock analysts like to use the term coiling. It's coiling for a move that I think is going to take it over 1400 at some point. I expect it to happen this year, but for the last 10 or so years, my expectations have usually, it takes longer than what I expect it will take to happen. But, you know, obviously the economic fundamentals are strengthening in terms in gold's favor. The geopolitical elements that drive gold are strengthening in gold's favor. And if you just kind of look at the way the trader positions in the Commitment of Traders report shifts around, it's shifted into a structure that, you know, call it a structure of the cot that is neutral and turning favorable for gold and silver. So, I don't know when we're going to see the next move begin, but I think the market has been setting up, and the longer it kind of trends sideways, the more powerful the next move higher will be.
What do you think about the performance of the miners and some of the major miner ETFs relative to the price of gold? Many commentators have described the current mining investment sector and the junior miners as boring. And I go through to kind of gauge sentiment, look at the comment section on YouTube videos that discuss these things or Kitco articles, and it seems like many people are discouraged. What do you see as the relationship between the performance of the miners relative to gold and what that may be speaking of for the future?
Sure. I mean, there's no question that the sector as a whole, again, it's kind of stale because it's kind of drifting, you know. It goes lower for a bit, then it moves higher and people get optimistic, and then it goes lower again. You know, it's the stocks have been kind of following gold in that trading range for quite some time, and people are getting impatient. I mean, I've seen this because I've been doing this sector since 2001, and I've seen it, you know, time and again, where, you know, unfortunately, you know, most investors are shorter term. I mean, most of the investors that I chat with now weren't even in the sector before 2012 or 2014, or a lot of them are new to the sector since the market bottomed out in the end of 2015. And it's a sector that really requires a long-term perspective, because at its root level, it's about money, honest money, as opposed to fiat paper currency. And it takes a long time for changes in monetary regimes to shift. I mean, look at how long it took for the world to shift from essentially what was a gold standard before World War II into the U.S. being the reserve currency of the world. I mean, that you're talking about a 35, 40 year shift, and it happened in stages, you know, Bretton Woods and then 1971. And there was some mini stages in between that sort of kept the dollar moving toward becoming a pure fiat currency and the reserve currency. So if we are headed towards a global monetary system that will have gold involved in the money supply and in the monetary foundation, and to some extent we kind of already are, because, you know, arguably the Fed may or may not hold gold, which is supposedly holding on behalf of the Treasury, but a lot of central banks around the world do own gold as part of their reserves, and it's considered a tier one asset. So that means that in terms of, in central bank terms, it's interchangeable for fiat currency. So, to that extent, the foundation is set up there to reintroduce gold into the monetary system. I think that's what we're slowly seeing. And part of what's keeping a lid on the price of gold is Western elitist interests are trying to prevent that from happening. Obviously, it runs counter to their wealth building interests to reintroduce gold into the global monetary system. So I guess that's sort of a roundabout way to say, you know, I think you got to be patient, and sometimes the best times to, you know, sit tight and be right, or even add more money to an investment sector, is when no one else wants it. And we're sort of in a period like that right now, in terms of just judging by, as you pointed out, the general sentiment toward the sector. So, and for me, that's when I'm like, this is the best time to buy. I mean, when I came out of business school in 91, everyone said the junk bond market was dead. And I was like, no, no one else is going into it. And so I'm going into it. And I think out of the top 10 schools, there were two graduates, myself and one other guy, went into the junk bond market. And then obviously the rest is history from there in terms of how the junk bond market developed. So, you know, again, I think it's just a long-winded way of saying, you know, if you own it, sit tight and be right. If you really believe in it, don't just sit tight. Start slowly wading into more positions. And not every mining stock has gone sideways or down. I mean, we can talk about Excelsior Mining, which I recommended in my mining stock journal. I'd have to look it up, but call it 6 months ago. And it was around 78, 80 cents. And I mean, it's been as high as $1.10, and it closed on Friday at $1.03. So over, call it a 6 month period, that's a heck of a rate of return, 25%.
And what were the main catalysts driving that stock? That's not one I followed.
They've got a copper project in Arizona, and It's a very robust deposit, and they are going to employ what's called the in situ extraction process, and it's
like uranium mining.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been done with copper before, and they have all their permits in place now. They just recently got their federal mining permit, or environmental permit, really, which lets them mine. And they're going, they may actually get production started by the fourth quarter this year. And it was just one of these companies, when someone showed me the idea and I listened to the presentation, I had never heard of it. And I don't really, you know, my mining stock journal is primarily gold and silver stocks. You know, copper's, you know, occasionally there'll be a copper play in there, like Almadex, which was a major league home run. But I don't go out looking for copper ideas, and I looked at it and I heard the presentation, and it was, again, it was trading right around 80 cents, and I started running some numbers on it, because if they meet what their projections are, and this in situ extraction process, as you know, I think it's a little more reliable and predictable than the typical, you know, crush the ore and then extract it with cyanide. And then further process it there in a doré bars. You know, I think it tends to have a little more consistent extraction results. And I'm just kind of shooting from the hip there, but that was kind of my impression, because here's a company that has about a $200 million market cap now, and they're projecting that they'll do by year seven of the mine $300 million in free cash flow. So that would be EBIT. The way free cash flow there is defined is EBITDA less less sustaining CapEx. And we're talking about, you know, by year seven, this thing's going to be throwing off, you know, 33% more cash flow than the current market cap of the company. And when I look at something like that, I'm like, this is a no-brainer. I mean, yeah, there is some risk that something could happen that derails their ability to produce. But you're at the point now where, like I said, I think they're getting ready to they'll probably start producing by the fourth quarter this year. So
what's their mine life? A lot of times copper projects have longer mine life than gold.
I mean, this thing they're looking at, they've got it running 23, 24 years.
Yeah, some of these copper mines can be 50 plus years.
And in their first full year of operation, so let's just say, you know, for argumentative purposes, their first full year is 2019, they're going to do $50 million a year in free cash flow. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just on that basis, it's a $200 million market cap trading at four times free, and really it's four times free cash flow as opposed to EBITDA. You can't find any company in the NASDAQ that trades anywhere remotely close to four times cash flow. Those companies are trading, you know, at 40 times cash flow. So on a relative value basis, this is an extreme value play.
And it has $3 copper, I would assume, or thereabouts.
Actually, no, their base case feasibility study uses $2.75 copper. And that's one of the things that I liked about it when I saw it. You know, they weren't using pie in the sky numbers. They're using a 7.5% discount rate, and most juniors, when they're making, you know, like their pre-feasibility analysis or their preliminary economic analysis, they're only using a 5% discount rate. And these guys
are, because it's in America.
Yeah, and it's at Canadian companies do it too. It's just kind of a standard. Now, I'm seeing some junior mining companies moving toward using a higher discount rate, 7.5%. But, you know, these guys, their return assumptions are very conservative. Their base case is using 275 with a 7.5% discount rate, and this thing has a 40% IRR and an $807 million after-tax NPV. So versus a $200 million market cap now and almost completely de-risked, I mean, this thing to me is a no-brainer. I mean, your risk is the price of copper. And if we go into a global economic severe recession, the price of copper is going to take a hit. But there, again, this thing has a $522 million after-tax NPV using 225 copper. So copper could take a big hit, and this thing still is, you know, on sort of your most conservative assumptions, this thing's still undervalued relative to its potential.
Can you talk about what you look for as well as warning signs when you're looking at a late-stage development company that's made it to at least a pre-feasibility stage? What are some things that are like red flags where you say, I'm not going to touch that thing? And then what would you be looking for going on financially with the company? You know, not just cash on hand, but ways in which they're looking at bringing the project into existence.
That's a great question. And it's always, so for instance, there's a company that I featured in my Mining Stock Journal early in the Mining Stock Journal's evolution. So it would have been like the spring or summer of 2006, Treasury Metals. And it's up in Canada. It's, don't hold me to this, I think it's in the Timmins camp. It's a really nice project. They've got, again, I'm just running these numbers off the top of my head, well over 1 million ounces of, I think it's measured and indicated. And they are, I mean, they're getting really close to whether they're going to make a decision to go forward or not with building a mine. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait, you've got all the pieces in place. You know, what could derail this thing? And it's, I mean, the ability to raise capital to put in the mine, that could be a huge derailment. I mean, you know, if it's an underground mine, those things can cost a lot of money to build. Capital markets might not be there to finance it. So that's a potential risk. You know, usually by the time at which they're at the feasibility study, they've got most of the kinks ironed out. They've got a resource that has demonstrable metallurgy, meaning it, you know, that it can be successfully extracted at the current price of gold. They've got their, you know, any kind of political issues have been taken care of. They've got their permits in place. You know, I think at that point, it's just kind of like you got to look at the project and say, okay, this thing makes sense. And even if the price of gold drops $100 between now and when they start production, it's still going to throw off cash flow. You know, to me, the risks, once they're at the feasibility point and they got to start looking for financing, the two risks that you got to consider are financing risks and the price of gold or price of silver risk. And those are both market risks. And those are, to a large degree, they're out of the company's control or out of anyone's control. But, you know, that's why you can buy these stocks and make, you know, a 50% return in a year because of the risk involved.
One stock that I've corresponded with you regarding before I purchased the position last December was Tahoe Resources, which you've covered in your Mining Stock Journal. Can you comment on Tahoe Resources and what you think the value proposition is now and for the future of that company?
Sure. What price did you get in?
$4.39 a share. That was my cost basis.
Oh, so you're happy.
Yeah, absolutely. But it did actually, it went up over $5, then it went down to, I want to say, $3.80. after the earnings call, and then it shot up 18% like the next trading day after that. So I'm definitely in the money at this point.
Well, 60 cents on 439 in a year, that's not too bad.
Yep.
That's what, about 14% or something?
Yeah, so far. I'm expecting a lot more, though, especially with the Guatemala mine, you know, coming back into production, 20 million ounces of silver a year. I bought it not only because of the gold production, which made a lot of sense, but also because of the hoped for double in a day if that silver mine comes back into production.
You know, I think that double in a day when the news hits, or if it hits, that they can resume operations at the mine, that double in a day I think's been partially priced out of it already. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get a double, but you should get a dollar or two pop. Then, you know, as you mentioned, the real upside to this stock hinges on what happens in Guatemala. I mean, I guess for your listeners, the story there is that a local group of activists filed a lawsuit against Tahoe, and a local court issued an injunction and enforced it to shut down. It had something to do with environmental. Breaching of environmental regulations or something. It's been a while since I've actually talked about the story. I'm just sort of waiting for it to, you know, finish. And at any rate, the issue is being at the local court in Guatemala is called the Supreme Court, and the what they call the Constitutional Court now is looking at the issue and deciding on it. And I thought there would have been some sort of decision rendered by now, but there hasn't. And so this thing's been dragging out longer than I thought, and definitely longer than the company thought. But if you discard the Guatemala operation and just look at its other silver operations in Peru, it's got two mines there, and then it's got some very profitable gold mines in Canada. You know, at $5 a share, Tahoe is undervalued just looking at its gold mining operations. And then you throw in the two smaller silver operations in Peru. And even without Guatemala, I think this stock is going to, it'll perform well as the price of gold goes higher. Because, I guess some people might still put it in the junior category because it's not as big as Goldcorp or Newmont or Barrick, but I consider it, you know, a major league mining company.
For a stock like this, it was trading, you know, a year ago, I believe, over $9. And when so many people get burned, They bought at 9, 10. I mean, it was over, I believe, 20. I'm doing this from memory. I'm not looking at the chart. A couple years ago, people who bought higher then, of course, sold lower. They get burned. What does it take, and how long does it take for a company like that to really shake off all that baggage and negative investor feelings towards the stock before the stock can really start to fly, assuming, the price of gold is going up and the company is running well?
Sure. And to be fair, it's part of that drop in the stock is going to be market related, right? Because for the last year, gold and silver have gone sideways to down, and the mining stocks have also gone for the most part sideways to down. So but you're right. Most of that drop in the price, which was when the mine was shuttered, it was at 850 and the stock dropped down to 550. And so a lot of the volatility in the stock's been kind of related to any kind of news or announcements that might be made connected to that mine as opposed to what the market's doing. I think, hopefully people understood there's always political risk in a country like Guatemala with investing in this stock. And I mean, that was one of the things I liked about Tahoe. If the political risk didn't come to the surface, it was very undervalued, with the Guatemala mine in operation, Escobal. So, especially as the price of silver moves higher, again, this is a situation where at this point, I don't know how this is going to be resolved. I know the U.S. State Department and I think it was the embassy down there released a statement encouraging the Constitutional Court to make a decision on this. And they threw some language in there that was encouraging them to rule in favor of Tahoe. And I knew from talking to the company, I don't know, probably about 6 or 9 months ago, I spoke to I was actually their attorney who's does a lot of their political relations work. And I knew that she was talking to the U.S. government about helping them out there. So the other thing you need to consider here, besides just the political activism that might be opposed to the mine, is that the mine is a major employer down there. I think Tahoe is responsible for like somewhere between 1 and 2% of Guatemala's GDP, and so I can guarantee you that the government is missing out on that. They really are not happy with missing out on the tax revenues and the royalties that they collect from when this mine operates. So, but it's like this country, the government, I'm assuming they're trying as hard as possible to be a democracy, and they're not going to go in there and overrule the court on this. They got to let the legal system down there run its due course. So, we'll see what happens. Again, I mean, this company, and I haven't looked at the cash balance in a while, but I think they have about 170 million in cash right now. If they just had to shut down this mine and leave, they've got there's the one thing that, and this kind of gets back to just the mining stocks and especially the junior mining stocks in general. The one thing that this last, call it 12 to 18 months has done is it has created a lot of very, very undervalued junior mining stocks. And I say undervalued based on what a lot of these juniors already have in the ground and what they've already proved. And they're trading at substantial discounts to, where they would be trading if the price of gold was at 1400 and the sentiment was a lot stronger in this market. So my point here with Tahoe is they got plenty of cash to go out and make some acquisitions if they have to, replace the revenue stream that they would miss out by shutting down the Escobal mine in Guatemala. And there's plenty of those acquisitions just in Nevada. So, if you don't like the political risk associated with mining, there's plenty of junior miners just in Nevada that are extremely undervalued right now. And I think if Tahoe were to, get shut out on the Guatemala, I think you'd see them pretty quickly look to build their gold mining operations by acquiring some junior miners. For instance, Treasury Metals would be a great acquisition for them, and it would blend in nicely with with their operations, the two gold operations they have in Canada now.
Dave, you write the Short Sellers Journal as well as the Mining Stock Journal. So my next question relates to shorting mining stocks. What's your general perspective on shorting mining stocks, and how and when do you do that? And if you could share any examples, please.
Sure. In general, I'm kind of opposed to shorting mining stocks because it's, to me, it's, you know, these juniors are kind of like the internet stocks were in the, you know, the late 1990s. You know, as opposed to a lot of those internet stocks were no revenues, no prospects, and they were still getting $1 to $2 billion market caps. A lot of these juniors are working on developing properties, and even if they end up with a property that only has 500,000 ounces on it, if the price of gold is you know between $1,500 and $2,000 an ounce, that means that junior mining company is going to be worth a lot of money. Now, right now, relative to that potential, these companies are trading at pennies on the dollar. So I don't think that's the type of story that you want to short because it's a thinly traded market. The companies don't have a lot of share float outstanding. And you know, if you're short one of these stocks and all of a sudden the market takes off, you're going to feel like you got run over by a herd of elephants. So in general, I don't recommend shorting, especially individual names. Now, there has been over the last couple of years, I have put some, you know, avoid this name type ideas in the Mining Stock Journal, and I did it with MX Gold, and I'd have to look up the chart price, but it might have been like at 30 cents, and now I think it's under 10 cents. And as we were talking earlier, Bill, I did it with, you know, I put Northern Dynasty in there. I said, just avoid it because this property is, in my opinion, it's never going to get developed. And Northern Dynasty was at, now I didn't recommend shorting it. I just said, avoid it. I said, if you're aggressive, you might want to short it. And that was at $1.38 when I recommended that. And now the stocks, I think it's closed at 47 cents on Friday. And then that Novo Resources, when that thing traded up over $6, I actually tried to borrow it for our fund and short it. And I couldn't get, our custodian that we use for our fund wouldn't let us short a five-letter stock. So we weren't able to short it, but I did put in my mining stock journal, I advised my readers to avoid it. And then, you know, the stock went from six to under three, and I think it's probably back over four now. And again, you know, that's one of those stocks that I would recommend avoiding at this point until there's a lot more news out on it that shows that they have something that not only do they have a viable resource there, but it's something that can be viably converted into gold that they can sell. So, I guess it's probably a long-winded way of saying in general, if I don't like a junior mining stock, I don't, you know, I wouldn't tell someone to short it. I would just tell them to avoid it. So that's my view on whether or not you should short mining stocks. In terms of what I would potentially recommend is you there's things that you can do to hedge a long portfolio in mining stocks. And in our fund, when we think that there's going to be a period of time where gold's going to be manipulated lower and, you know, it's a volatile sector, so the mining stocks are going to have, you know, say a 10% to 20% pullback, what we do is we'll hedge out at least 50% of our long position of our mining stocks, and sometimes up to 100% if we want to, you know, get a little speculative in terms of our view on a pullback or a, you know, a short-term downtrend in the sector. And the way that we do that is we use JDST, which is the inverse of JNUG. And the reason why we use that is because it's triple leveraged, and we can put on a hedge using JDST that it only costs us a third of the total size of our stock portfolio, right? Because there's three times leverage there. So a third of the value of JDST versus the total market cap of our share portfolio is theoretically should move the same, right? in percentage wise. And we take it even further than that, because you can do it with putting up even less capital, and that's to use deep in the money calls that are near expiration. So as an example, JDST closed on Friday at 49.86. And if you take a look at the JDST 42 calls that expire next Friday, on Friday they went out, indicated 740 bid, 840 offered. So if you can buy those for $8 per option, you're essentially going long JDST with about 14 cents of premium, because you got the cost of the option plus the strike price is 50. JDST closed at 49.86, so there's 14 cents of premium in there. And that's just the cost of putting on a less capital-intensive hedge than actually going out and buying the number of shares in JDST that we would need to use the hedge position. And then there's also transactions costs involved there, because if we continue to believe the market is going to go lower, and I'm not saying I think the market's going lower next week, but we'll roll the call options forward to the next week. And we try to pick out a deep in the money call option that will minimize the amount of time premium that we pay, because it obviously reduces the cost of the hedge. So the other problem with these triple levered trusts is that because they're essentially pure derivatives, they have a huge time premium decay. I've seen articles where these triple levered trusts, and it doesn't matter what it is, they lose about 10% a month because of the premium decay. So that's why we look at it in terms of a short-term trade. We use short-term calls, and our preference is to not go long the actual trust, because you're kind of, with that decay factor in there, you're kind of swimming upstream, and you need a big move in a short period of time to actually do well going long either of these trusts, whether it's JDST if you've got a bearish view or JNUG if you've got a bullish view.
Would you say if one was looking to short junior mining stock, and that was possible, the best candidate would be a stock that had a parabolic run-up due primarily to a newsletter promotion?
Yes, absolutely. So, and we've saw that with Novo Resources. We've seen it with Northern Dynasty. We were seeing it with MX Gold.
What about, when a pre-revenue junior company does a large financing and there's a five-year warrant attached to it, and the warrant might be 30% or 40% only above the current range that the stock is trading in, you know you're going to have millions of shares become free trading in about 4 months. Have you ever tried to short a stock, at 3.5 months before you know all that free trading shares are going to come open?
Not really. I mean, generally when warrants become exercisable and if they're in the money, it generally doesn't create a large sell-off in the stock. There might be a small technical sell-off. Again, for me, I just don't like to mess around with shorting these shares, because what happens if you short the shares anticipating, the lockup period on the warrants expires and all of a sudden people exercise their warrants and dump their shares? What happens if between, when you short it and that point, the sector takes off and you're looking at a stock that might go from, just to throw some numbers out there, might go from 40 cents to 80 cents. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What about the electrical vehicle revolution? If I could preface this intro by saying, in my opinion, you're probably one of the greatest Twitter critics of Elon Musk and Tesla. You can share your thoughts with Tesla if you could, but beyond Tesla, what are your thoughts regarding the macro narrative of the electrical vehicle revolution and the increased need for battery minerals?
Sure. I think these EVs are, you could say, okay, well, Tesla pioneered the way. Well, guess what? Right behind that, you've got Audi, BMW, Porsche, Jaguar, Honda, you've got, and then the U.S. producers, they're all, within 2 or 3 years, the market's going to be flooded with a lot of different models at a lot of different price points. So there's no question that the shift into EVs is going to become a mainstream trend. I do, again, I don't spend a lot of time studying the issue. I mean, I drive a gas-powered Audi, and I'm very happy with it. And I think until the price of gasoline becomes unaffordable for most households, I think most people probably will stick with their gasoline-powered cars. I mean, these EVs, I think, still have a lot of development to do before they can be considered interchangeable with a gas-powered car. For instance, the battery range, things like that. It's also, I guess, my understanding is the battery life is not as long as people think it might be when they buy these cars, and to replace the batteries is very expensive. And then you got the environmental hazards connected to disposing of the batteries. That's kind of like the white elephant connected to battery-powered vehicles that no one talks about. I think a lot of these batteries are getting dumped in the ocean, and that kind of disconcerts at least me. So, but in terms of creating the need for kind of the base elements that go into making batteries, I know there's projected to be a cobalt shortage that's developing, because I guess cobalt is an essential ingredient in making these batteries. And that, as you mentioned it, I mentioned earlier that I pretty much focus only on gold and silver mining stocks. Well, as it turns out, there's a junior mining company that had bought a property in Canada to develop the silver potential of the property, and they happened to discover a ton of cobalt on the property. And they're in the process of advancing that and drilling it out. And I recommended that one in my mining stock journal. It was probably 3 or 4 issues ago, maybe 2 or 3 issues ago. And ordinarily I'd give you the name, but it's such a new idea for my subscribers that I like to kind of embargo sharing ideas with the public for a while and let my subscribers decide if they want to buy it or not. And this particular company, I spent a lot of time on the phone with the CEO. They also have a silver mine that they're developing, and just without the cobalt property, the silver mine is potentially a massive home run. So, but right now it's if you look at what the market cap of the company is, and you look at what I think it's called U.S. Cobalt is there's
Acquiring or being acquired by First Cobalt, I
that's what it
believe.
is. First Cobalt, sort of the Mac Daddy of the pure cobalt producers. If you look at what First Cobalt is paying for properties out there that have cobalt in the ground, but are a long way from being developed, this company could probably flip their cobalt property for pretty close to the current market cap of the entire stock, and that would give you the silver property for free. Now, they're not going to do that, because if they can prove out a big cobalt resource on their property, I mean, obviously the cobalt property alone is worth, 10 times what they could sell it for now. So, and this is an idea that I really like. It's got a low stock float. The CEO has experience in a prior life of his. He took an energy property and developed it into a home run and sold it into a major. So, I think on a risk return basis, this is probably one of my more favorite new ideas that I've been presenting to my Mining Stock Journal subscribers.
If I could get your response to this, when I was at PDAC in Toronto about 2.5 months ago, I overheard someone say, and they said, "It's my opinion that Tesla will end up being a battery company. It's tough to make cars." Do you have any thoughts or a response to that opinion?
I think that's kind of optimistic for Tesla's future. I think Tesla's going to run itself into the ground, quite frankly. I mean, you're looking at a company that burns close to $1 billion of cash flow every quarter. They've got a massive amount of debt. I mean, companies like that shouldn't be financed with debt. Right now, using financial theory, the bond market is telling you the stock is worthless because the bonds are trading at about 85 cents on the dollar. And as you know, in a strict bankruptcy scenario, bonds get paid off at 100% before equity gets anything. And the bond market is telling you these bonds aren't even worth par. So that means theoretically the stock is worth zero. So at a $50 billion market cap, that's a really expensive option on the future of Tesla. And again, we're going to start seeing, I think Audi's coming out with an EV that's, I think the price point is going to compete with the Tesla Model S. And it's supposed to be far superior. And a good friend of mine who actually, he works in finance and he's toured the Gigafactory and he said the thing's just a complete disaster. He recently toured it. And he's brought up the good point that once these competing models come out and they start getting reviews, it's just going to, I mean, they're going to compare extremely favorably to the Teslas. And the thing I don't understand about Tesla is those Model S's, we had a stretch there a few weeks ago where it was like every week the Model S was crashing. They think it's related to the autopilot catching on fire and incinerating the occupants. You know, I'm not sure how the government lets these Model S's, you know, that I don't understand how they don't at least put in a recall until they figure out why these things catch on fire when they. I think Tesla's going to become eventually a bankruptcy liquidation.
Yeah, and Elon Musk has been getting a lot more ornery with his investors on the conference call when I read some of the transcript, and I think he's kind of frustrated with the PR his company's getting.
Well, he only has himself to blame. You know, you live in Michigan. Tesla reminds me, remember the DeLorean?
You mean from Back to the Future, the movie?
Yeah, well, that was the car that was Back to the Future. But remember John DeLorean?
Uh-huh.
I mean, to me, it's kind of a similar profile. DeLoreans, it was a great sports car. I mean, stainless steel, it looked great. The place where I go get my Audi service, they actually have an old DeLorean in their warehouse. You know, and every time I go there to get my oil changed, I just saw it the other day. It just reminds me of John DeLorean. I think his fate was ultimately decided. I think he was trying to sell a big briefcase full of cocaine to keep, you know, to get cash to keep the money going, if I recall the story correctly. But that's something like that happened. And, you know, Elon Musk's personality profile kind of reminds me, you know, similar to DeLorean's. You know, he has a great idea, but he's crazy. And, you know, you're seeing it in his public persona now. I really think he's mentally, I think he's melting down.
Yeah, I imagine he's under a lot of stress. Because I know there's a lot of people that aren't happy, and his critics seem to be piling on.
But here's the other thing about it. He comes out and he tweets these financial projections and these production projections, and they never even come remotely close. And every time he tweets something, you know, that's positive, that he thinks is going to be positive, the stock jumps up. And to me, I don't know how the SEC doesn't shut that down. I mean, you don't see the CEOs of these junior mining companies getting onto Twitter and saying, hey, you know, we're a year away from producing 1 million ounces a year. You know, they don't do that. But that's kind of the equivalent of what Musk has been doing. And, you know, I just don't understand how the stock, you know, stays at this market cap the way that it does, other than I think it's perpetually under a short squeeze because it's a very heavily shorted stock.
Well, Dave, I appreciate our conversation. I'm sure the listeners do as well. Before you take off, is there anything you'd like to share in light of what we talked about? And could you update us regarding what Investment Research Dynamics has to offer?
Sure. I think, you know, again, I think we're in a period of time here where, you know, with the precious metals and the mining stocks, you want to just sit tight and be right. You know, I'm not aggressively wading into the market. In my fund, buying shares, we have some cash, but we've also got a lot of it invested. And we put a lot of that cash to work over the last couple months. It does look like there's some money that's starting to accumulate these shares again. U.S. gold is one that you and I talked about. You know, it took a hit, but now all of a sudden it looks like it's being accumulated again. And I just want to say that hit that U.S. gold took was completely unwarranted. They didn't have any news released. You know, it was a technical sell off that I think the shorts piled onto, and it's, I know our custodian has emailed us several times trying to borrow our shares, and they're paying 50% annualized rate of interest to if you lend them their shares, which of course we don't. I heard Ameritrade was offering U.S. gold shareholders like 65% to borrow shares. So that tells you right there there's a short squeeze coming down the road. But at any rate, I mean, the U.S. gold story is on the come. I mean, they've got their copper gold project in Wyoming, and that property alone is worth the market cap of the stock. So then you get the Cortez Trend Keystone project for free. And that thing, you know, and again, ultimately there may not be anything there that's mineable, but I've spoken to Dave Mathewson, the chief geologist, who's really kind of running the company, and you can just tell from his body language that he knows, he can smell there's something there underneath the ground, and he's been responsible for some of the largest gold finds in Nevada. So it's one of those things. The news is on the come. If you buy it here, you're going to be able to buy it at a great price. I think it closed yesterday at what, like $1.45 or something. And
it was like up 5%, I think.
Yeah, and so it's you know, I think it bottomed out around $1.20. So
yeah, and the trading volume just died on that stock too.
Yes, and that's actually a good sign, because the fact that it's been moving higher, especially in this market environment, tells you that it's being accumulated. So they're going to start drilling on the Keystone property, I think, within the next couple weeks, and we should start seeing some drill news released by the end of July. And if any of those holes come back hot, that stock's going to fly.
And there's limited downside at this point, like you said, with their Copper King property. You have the intrinsic value there, so. I mean, I can't see it going much below 20 million market cap.
Right. I mean, the market cap right now is, what, about 23, 24 million, something like that. That's off the top of my head. But I know when I spoke to the CEO a while ago, he said if someone offered him 50 million for the Copper King property, he might think about selling it. And he said he's been offered, you know, between, you know, around 10 or 15 million for it. So, you know, essentially the bare bones valuation on that, the Copper King property is not too far below the market cap of the stock. So to me, it's basically a free option on what could end up being a home run property in one of the richest gold trends in the world, in Nevada.
Yeah, having a stock on the NASDAQ with the name U.S. Gold in a gold bull market, I mean, that alone, the shares are going to run up pretty high.
Yes, exactly. And I know that the CEO's kind of he knows he's not going to get institutional investors really involved in the story until they start producing drilling results. So I know he's been going around and working, you know, retail investors, which are your primary investors and juniors anyway, and building up a large retail base of shareholders. And once you start getting institutions involved, that's when the stock could really take off, especially because it's only got, I think, 17 million shares outstanding.
Yeah, like fully diluted.
Yes, fully diluted. And this guy, Dave Mathewson, the guy who's basically, you know, the chief geologist, he takes 75% of his pay in stock. So to me, that's a huge affirmation of what he believes the potential is for this property. So, but at any rate, I update stocks like Excelsior Mining and U.S. Gold, you know, every issue in my mining stock journal. And, you know, your listeners can find out more about either the mining stock journal or the short sellers journal at my website, investmentresearchdynamics.com.
And you do about three commentaries a week, usually, like blog posts about current macro of economics or particular topics you're thinking about.
Yes, I try to do like maybe five posts a week, but you know, I spend most of my time that I spend writing is either writing the Mining Stock Journal or the Short Seller Journal. So the Mining Stock Journal is twice a month, and the Short Seller Journal is every Sunday. So on weeks where I have to get both of them out, you know, I'm probably spending 60 hours during that week writing my journal, so, and researching for my journal. So sometimes it gets a little bit harder to post, to do blog posts. But yeah, I try to shoot for 4 to 5 a week.
Well, Dave, I appreciate your time and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks again for having me, Bill. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.